say forest fires or automobile accidents, you know, or an assault. All of those things are potential traumas. The research has shown very clearly that most people are not traumatized by those events. They're not happy about those events. They're difficult, they suffer some, but they move on from them.
Professor George Bonanno.
Clinical psychologist, trauma expert.
Now, trauma is when we can't get over those events. Then we are traumatized by that event. And that's not nearly as common as people tend to think it is. It's a pretty horrific experience. And many people talk about the nightmares during a medically induced coma as worse than whatever brought them into the medically induced coma. Over the years, what we've found is there are ideas about resilience. Many of the ideas are there's a type of person that's resilient. There are a few key traits, kind of the magic traits that people have. One possible explanation we could say is maybe we invented it. And certainly people have suggested that we invented the whole idea of trauma. It's a modern phenomenon. I don't think that's really true, but I think...
Hey there, friends. Welcome to the Happy Habit Podcast. I'm your host, Matthew. We're fast approaching 400 episodes. Yes, an awful lot of talk about health, well-being, motivation, and inspiring interviews over the last 4 years. And if you're new to the podcast, thank you so much for stopping by. So many new listeners and downloaders and subscribers. If you've not already done so, please like, subscribe, and share with somebody who you think might enjoy listening as much as you are. And a little favor too, if you get the chance, please leave the podcast a positive rating, be it 3, 4, 5 stars, whatever you think the podcast has earned. That would be fab because it certainly helps spread the message of what we're doing here. We are now on YouTube and on Instagram. If you want to subscribe over there, you're more than welcome to do so. Now, today I'm talking to a very interesting professor. His name is George Bonanno. He is a clinical psychologist and author of The End of Trauma and The Other Side of Sadness. In this episode, we define what trauma means as far as the professor is concerned and how it differs from the commonly accepted definition of trauma. Plus, we ask why the conventional wisdom on trauma is so at odds with Professor Bonanno's findings. The professor asks why trauma only crops up in the literature a couple of hundred years ago when it should be present all throughout human history. We hear about PTSD and how it doesn't apply to everyone who has experienced a traumatic life event. We learn about resilience, the traits of resilience, the resilience paradox, and why a flexibility mindset is so important. Expect to learn what steps to take in order to enhance your resilience. Plus, we explore how the lessons learned to bolster our resilience can be applied in the grieving process. Well, Professor George Bonanno, clinical psychologist, author of The End of Trauma and The Other Side of Sadness, thank you so much for joining me today. You're very, very interested in trauma. Can we first of all define trauma for you and then tell me why you think conventional wisdom is incorrect in its approach to defining trauma?
Well, okay. Well, first of all, trauma is, there's a lot of misunderstanding about that word. In the sort of official way we think about trauma in the profession, in professional psychology, psychiatry, there is an event that's considered a trauma, and then there is a response, which is typically when it's a response that endures is called PTSD. So a lot of the confusion comes from the fact that when PTSD was set up as a diagnosis, it requires that a person has experienced a trauma. And I think that's part of the problem, that trauma is, I use the phrase in my research, potential trauma, or I use the acronym PTEs, and I force myself to do this, potentially traumatic event, potential trauma. An event is a potential trauma. It's only a trauma only happens when the person cannot recover from it, when they are has suffering an enduring response. So being in a terrorist attack, being in a hurricane, you don't have hurricanes in Europe so much, but say forest fires or automobile accidents, or an assault, all of those things are potential traumas, because the research has shown very clearly that most people are not traumatized by those events. They're not happy about those events. They're difficult. They suffer some, but they move on from them. So I call those potential traumas. And then a trauma is when we can't get over those events. Then we are traumatized by that event. And that's not nearly as common as people tend to think it is.
In the book, you spell out the history, really, of trauma, or the lack thereof, really, because it only enters the zeitgeist, really, and the literature a couple of hundred years ago, or several generations ago. You talk about, if it's going to appear anywhere in the literature several thousand years ago, it would have appeared in Homer's Iliad. And you say there's a glaring absence of any reference to trauma in the Iliad. So can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, and it's very curious, and I'm certainly not the first person to notice that. But you would think we would see it in the past, some reference to enduring trauma after all these blood-curdling battles and things, you know. You see plenty of reference to grief, how people respond to the loss of a loved one, which is a completely different psychological experience, different psychological reaction. But we don't, and I don't really have an answer as to why. You know, one possible explanation we could say is maybe we invented it. And certainly people have suggested that we invented the whole idea of trauma. It's a modern phenomenon. I don't think that's really true, but I think in the past, it was not, people didn't understand it. They were confused by it. They were maybe ashamed of it. Maybe it wasn't just psychologically plausible to let oneself be so vulnerable as to be traumatized. This is a modern luxury we have. One of my favorite examples is from Samuel Pepys, the British diarist. He was a 17th century aristocrat, I mentioned in the book, who kept a diary. He's not known for anything except, you know, he was an aristocrat, and aristocrats come and go, but he kept a diary for 10 years, recorded intimate details, and he didn't intend it to be read. He wrote it in code, you know, and he didn't show, he really kept it private, and it was discovered kind of 100 years after his death, and people began to look at these many volumes of his diaries. And in the diaries, he talks about these adverse reactions he's had to the Great London Fire of 1666. And he describes essentially being traumatized, having nightmares that he can't get out of his head, fears of the fire, you know, recurring intrusive thoughts. All these are what we consider symptoms of PTSD. But this is many, many months, 6 months after the fire. He's completely confused by that. He doesn't know what to make of it. And he doesn't tell anybody. It's a very private thing. So I think that's a good evidence that people were having those reactions, but they were just confusing to them, you know, as if it was some sort of weakness. And certainly in the 20th century, and even in the late 19th century, it was often seen as a weakness, you know, and famously in World War I, and unfortunately, many soldiers were, the phrase shot at dawn, you know, you don't really have shell shock, you have, which is what it was called then, you are a coward. You're trying to get out of the war. So there was a real resistance to this, I think, that I think based on all that, we can conclude it did exist. Trauma did exist in the past. We just didn't know what to make of it, or we were frightened of it.
Can we talk about Jed? Jed, for want of a better word, is the protagonist at the start of the book that you use in order to illustrate trauma, lack of trauma, and this phenomenon of resilience. Can you tell us a little bit more about Jed and the accident that he and...
Oh, sure. Yeah. Jed's story is quite gripping. So he was a young man in New York City. I got to know him quite well. This is how I know the story. He came to work with me eventually. But he was working in a restaurant downtown in Greenwich Village around 1:30 in the morning. He left the restaurant. It was about 20 degrees here, which I think is something like -5 or -10 in Celsius, quite cold. The pavement was shimmering with ice, you know, and he walked out into the street. In New York City, it's illegal to make a right turn on a red light. And a sanitation truck, a garbage truck, came around the corner very fast and made an illegal right turn. Garbage trucks in New York City breaks a law routinely. They go very fast and they're enormous. They weigh, I don't remember what it is in kilograms. They weigh 20 tons in, 25 tons in U.S. metrics, but I don't remember what that is. They're enormous and heavy, and they basically ran him over and crushed his leg, his left leg, just a mass of blood and bone. And he was hospitalized. He was put into a medically induced coma for 6 weeks where they tried to keep him alive because he was just losing blood at such a rate. And they amputated his left leg and part of his hip. When he came to, he had all kinds of, when you're in a medically induced coma, it's possible to have nightmares that you cannot wake up from. One cannot wake up from a medically induced coma. It's a pretty horrific experience. And many people talk about the nightmares during a medically induced coma as worse than whatever brought them into the medically induced coma. So he had all that, woke up in the hospital, his leg and part of his left side of his body is gone, basically. And he had all these horrific intrusive memories. He remembered the whole thing. He was conscious for the whole thing. He was on the pavement for a long time before they brought him to the hospital. And he had all of this stuff, as he put it, all this stuff to process. And then in just a few days after that, it kind of went away. And he no longer had these sort of PTSD-like intrusive memories and thoughts. And he was completely confused by that. He'd just begun studying psychology. He was thinking of a career change, and he was absolutely perplexed. Why did this go away? How come I don't have PTSD? And this drove him actually to motivated him to study psychology in depth, and eventually he came to work with me in my lab, which is how I met him.
And so what he's exhibiting here is the phenomenon of resilience. That's certainly my take from it.
Yes.
So
yes.
How do we characterize resilience then? And why is resilience, why does it vary from person to person? Is it a case of the person's individual perspective? Is it as a result of their accumulated lived experience over years, their traits? What feeds into resilience?
Yeah, all of those. it's a curious phenomenon. I've spent my career trying to understand this. First of all, Jed is a charming man, and he's an admirable man, but he's not a Superman. You know, one doesn't have to be exceptional to be resilient, and I think that's one of the big lessons. And that was one of his questions: why was I resilient? Because I'm just like a normal guy. So over the years, what we found is there are ideas about resilience. Many of the ideas are there's a type of person that's resilient. There are a few key traits, kind of the magic traits that people have. You know, you see articles like this. A lot of this happened during the pandemic. We would see articles or hear it on the radio or see it in the media that these are the magic traits of resilient people. That the word magic wasn't used, but these are the key traits of resilient people. But it turns out there aren't any key traits. When we've actually looked at the research, we've looked at probably at least 50 different things that we found that correlate with resilience, that you can say, okay, this correlates with resilience, this correlates with resilience, many, many different things. And we'll find more. We'll keep finding more as we look for more. There are genetics. There's some genetics to it. There's personality. There's resources, coping strategies, all these different things, your support network, all of these things correlate with resilience. So how do we make sense of it? And how do resilient people make sense of it? People who ultimately find their way into resilience, what did they do? And it took us a number of years to work this out. And the answer seems to be what I call regulatory flexibility. We figured it out each time when something happens to us, each time we have to work out what's going to get me through this particular episode, this particular tough time. And we do. We get through it. Most people tend to get through it, but most people tend to be resilient. So it's a matter of kind of determining each time. And, you know, we've mapped out the different psychological pieces people use to do that, the different mechanisms. But it's, in the simplest terms, it's really kind of figuring out what's going to work in this particular situation at this time. And it's often a matter of trial and error. We try something and it doesn't work, and we try something else till we figure it out.
Well, we're talking about resilience. Can we talk about the term, which I hadn't heard before, the resilience paradox?
Yeah, so the resilience paradox is a little bit of what I just described. It's the fact that we know what correlates with resilience. We can measure it. You know, we can do all kinds of research, and many people have for years, and identified these things that correlate with resilience, but they don't actually tell us much about who will be resilient. A correlation is just simply, you know, two things co-occur, and it turns out in the language of statistics, the effects are small. And what that means in plain English is that something can correlate with something else, but the effect is so small, it hardly matters. So I'm trying to think of an example. You might say, you know, coffee makes you run better. You can run longer if you drink coffee. And it's probably, I think that's actually statistically true because caffeine helps you metabolize. But it's not going to help you win a marathon. I'm going to have coffee, now I'll win the marathon. I mean, many, many other things also will come into play. So it's a very small effect. It only moves the needle a little bit. So if we know all these different things that predict resilience, each one of these things only explains maybe 2% of who will be resilient and who not, 3%. They don't explain much. And so we literally have to have, you know, an enormous array of these factors in order to actually know. And we've done that using machine learning and other kinds of modern approaches, you know, these computational approaches where we can collect all these different things. We can get blood samples and look at how people's immune system works and their genetic underpinnings and all of these things. And we still can't actually predict it that well, even when we have all these different things. So the reason is, and this is what brings me back to flexibility again, the thing we've sort of worked out over the years is that the reason the effects are small, say, let's take, what's a good one? Let's take positive emotion. You know, right now, positive emotion is very popular. Having positive emotion, it promotes well-being. It's, you know, it's there's a movement called positive psychology where we're looking at these good things or mindfulness or something like that. But in fact, it might correlate with resilience only in the smallest way. The reason is because sometimes it's useful and sometimes it's not. In a certain situation, it may not be useful to be experiencing all kinds of positive emotions. In another situation, it might. Or it might be really useful to express a lot of emotion. Right now, you need to communicate and talk to people and tell them all about this. And that's really helpful in this situation. In another situation, it's not. Or another situation, it's really adaptive to distract yourself. And I don't mean through the entire situation, I mean at a particular point in time. So, you know, and these events that we experience are complicated and they transpire. When we're exposed to something horrific, you know, we don't have 2 hours, cope with it and we're done. It usually lasts a little while, even among people who are resilient, you know, going through something horrific might be on your mind and might be disturbing for us, at least a few weeks even. And during that time, we're coping with having had that experience. So during that time, we might cope in many different ways because it sort of changes over time. It sounds a little complicated, and it is a little complicated. The human mind is complicated. But the underlying point is, I think, simpler, which is that at each moment we're struggling with something, we again try to figure out what will work in this moment. And something we did the other day might have worked well for us, but it's not going to work in this moment. And that's really that process of kind of adapting as we go along is what brings us through those events.
So the flexibility mindset that characterizes and is at the heart of resilience is really about adaptation. And I'm thinking about somebody there like Viktor Frankl, for example, a great example, who obviously went through horrors in the Second World War in Auschwitz in the concentration camp, and he saw his relatives die right in front of his eyes. His ability to survive that came down to his ability to adapt to his horrific conditions that were changing from moment to moment.
Yeah, and I don't know in detail I think I read his work a long time ago. His book, I think, was Man's Search for Meaning.
That's it, yeah.
But what a number of people have suggested to me, like sometimes students will come up to me and they'll summarize Frankl's book, and they'll they remembered it, and they'll say, it's this, it's X. And the X is, you know, you must find meaning in something, or, you know, something like that. And I don't think that's actually accurate, because finding meaning works in some, like everything else, finding meaning works in one situation and doesn't work in another. You know, another person might be in a situation somewhat similar, and at times you need to distract yourself. And certainly, I mean, I can only imagine, I've never been, had to confront the horrors of being in a concentration camp, but I can imagine that there are times when you just have to get it off your mind, or just, you know, even engage in fantasy, or simply reframe it for yourself. Like, these people are evil. You know, I met a man who was tortured in Turkey not long ago. And he told me that he one of the things he did sometimes was to tell himself, these people who are doing these things to me, they're not doing it to me. They don't even know me. They're doing it to an idea. So it's not personal to me. And that particular kind of reframing at times helped him get through, which is very different than finding meaning in it. It's very different than distracting yourself. It's just a particular tool he used at different times, and at different times it was effective. So that appears to be how we do it. You know, I'm a scientist, so I'm not willing to say, I've answered the whole thing, we're done, I'll go home now. You know, this appears to be how people do things, and we're trying to understand this as best we can now.
It's amazing. I talk to so many psychologists and psychiatrists and counselors and therapists, and so often it comes back to a similar observation, whereby if you heighten your awareness and you become aware and you change your perspective and you reframe your outlook on something, it really can be the secret to unlocking and solving your problems.
Yes, it can. And again, in some situations and not others, you know, that. It's always a matter of balancing. I think this is a really important point, and this is a seminal point in our model that of flexibility. That this the last part of the model is, you ask yourself, is this working? You know, we go through these whole steps, these different steps of figuring out what's happening, looking at the tools we have to play with, the tools we have to work with, and then asking ourselves, is it working? And often it's not, because we're not perfect human beings. Even the healthiest person is making their best guess. And even the healthiest person will get it wrong sometimes. And many people assume then, many people give up at that. They assume, you know, I can't cope with this. I just can't do it. And it's frustrating. But in fact, resilience comes about when people then try something else, you know, and that's how the literature on all animals since we've been studying animals, and humans are animals, is it's a matter of trial and error. We have to kind of say, okay, I'm going to try this. This isn't helping. I'm going to try something else now. You know, I'm going to try talking about it. That didn't work. That didn't make me feel better. So I'm going to try, you know, spending a little time alone and reflecting, or I'm going to try just kind of getting it off my mind. I'm going to try, you know, not showing my emotion, or I'm going to try, you know, reframing it. All these different things that we can do, we can try another one. And it's by attending to this process that we actually learn how we cope. You know, we take in the information. These are the tools I have, and this is what I can try in different situations.
What role does self-talk play in this when it comes to trying to foster resilience? We hear all the time about the negative implications of negative and toxic self-talk, but what role does positive self-talk play, and goal-directed self-talk play?
Those are great questions. As you mentioned, there is a lot of negative self-talk we can do. We can say to ourselves, you know, oh, you dummy. And I confess I've done that many times, because I screw up a lot, you know, so. It's always, ah, you fool. But positive self-talk it's used often in sports and other kinds of fields, you know, education. But it's a kind of what self-talk is it's a condensation of what's more complex things in our mind. So we might say to ourselves, for example, as I just said, one self-talk dialogue is, is when you ask yourself, is it working? And you say, is this working? You can say it out loud. Actually, you can say it to yourself, or you can say, I'll get through this. The flexibility mindset is about sort of being willing to deal with the discomfort long enough to find a solution. That's really what the flexibility mindset is. It's a way of thinking to yourself, I'll get through this. Just let me figure it out. You know, what do I need to do here? And these are all things we can say to ourselves. It'll be okay. I'll get through this. I always seem to manage to get through things. What do I need to do now? What's happening to me? What do I need to do? Is this working? What am I able to do? What are the tools that I have? These are all sort of both statements and questions we can ask ourselves. And by saying those things in our minds clearly, or even saying them out loud, it really helpful because it kind of condenses the thought, right, in a very tangible way. And you mentioned distant self-talk. Distant self-talk is we actually put our name in it. We insert our name into that sentence, and it's very powerful. A lot of this comes from the work of another colleague of mine, Ethan Cross, who has developed, done a lot of research on this. So if I were to say, is this working? That's powerful. But if I were to say, George, is this working? You know, with this question to myself, it's almost as if somebody said that to me, or we're watching ourselves from a distance, you know, because we're talking to ourselves, having a dialogue with ourselves. And the research has shown very clearly this somehow makes it easier for people to regulate themselves because they get a little objectivity. They remove themselves a little bit from the intensity of the situation. So, you know, we could say, what tools do I have here to use? This is one of the pieces of the flexibility ideas. What tools do I have? We take stock of what we have at our disposal. Not everybody can do everything. So what tools do I have? And if I would say to myself, George, what tools do you have? Which is just gives it a little bit more intensity, a little bit more powerful question, and removes me a little bit, like it allows me the distance to think. And that's particularly relevant when we're coping with really lousy events, really horrific events. It's hard. You know, resilience is common, but it's really hard to get through these things. They're painful. We don't want to experience these things, but we do from time to time experience these horrific things. And we have no choice, really. We can basically let it overwhelm us, or we can get through it. And that process, it's hard. It's hard to get a little distance from it. It's hard to think clearly when we're so upset. So the self-talk is really helpful, and particularly distant self-talk, because it gives us a little bit more distance. It sort of takes it a little bit out of the realm of all the intense emotion we're feeling, and allows us to, in a way, talk with ourselves and think clearly. Even if it helps a little bit, it helps us work out the solution.
I really like that idea. I've never heard of that before, the notion of addressing yourself by your own name internally whenever you're having these conversations with yourself.
It takes a little getting used to.
Yeah. It's really interesting, actually. I must try that. As I said, I've never heard that before, but it sounds like it would be quite effective because certainly from a novel standpoint, I've never actually spoken to myself by addressing my Matthew this, Matthew that. It's always been you or I, but it's never been Matthew, that kind of thing. So that's interesting.
Yeah. And it does take getting used to it. I would advise trying it in private. It feels a little strange. And I think most of the time people do it either to themselves or in private. But it is very effective. Yeah, it's a clever thing.
There's a chapter in the book about the pandemic, and I know you wrote this during the pandemic, and I'm just interested to hear about your own observations in relation to humanity's resilience in the aftermath of that once-in-a-lifetime event, hopefully once-in-a-lifetime event.
Well, yeah, hopefully. I don't know about that. I mean, we seem to be in a global situation where pandemics can happen more easily now with all the air travel and things. But that was interesting, and I actually used the phrase the resilience blind spot for that, because I think when something massive happens, a large-scale event that influences a lot of people, there's a kind of, I don't have a good word for this. I hate to use the word hysteria. There's hysteria that goes all the way back, you know, to this 19th century Freud and the couch, you know, and the whole thing. But there's a kind of a contagion, maybe is a better word, where, you know, people get concerned about something. The war in the Middle East right now is another great example. Many people are concerned, and that concern kind of spills over on a global level. Of course, it gets picked up by the media, and it's 24/7. You can see updates and new articles about it and lots of spin. And so and it's on our minds that we're wired for difficult things. We're wired to detect threat. That's pretty clear. So our brains are going to pay attention. And after a while, all of this, the danger and the threat, and which is very much accentuated by the internet, I think, and by the way we get our information now, that has a way of kind of making it almost seem impossible that we will be resilient to these things. You know, these things can seem so bad, and everybody, you know, because of the sort of contagion aspect of this, it seems to magnify people's sense of doom about around these things, or sense of the inevitable, you know, heart-crushing pain we will all feel, and that we won't be able to get through this very easily. And then we do, often. Not easily, but we do get through all of these things, you know, and they recede into the background slowly. Of course, some people are affected in a very profound way, in a more direct way, that's going to be harder for them, the people directly involved. But many of these events are experienced by a relatively small number of people, smaller, but spread out to the whole world. And the COVID pandemic was an interesting example. The COVID pandemic, of course, many people died and many people got sick. But there was a lot of fear and anxiety during the COVID-19 pandemic for good reason. There was uncertainty, and the spread of information was also very useful. But there was a lot of misinformation too. You know, the points I really like to make is that scientists did one of the most remarkable, science achieved during the pandemic was nothing short of absolutely astounding. Science got on it right away. Progress in dealing with genetically modifying the bacteria to make a vaccine, that happened with such speed. It's almost astounding how quickly that was achieved. That because it was a global scientific effort, right? And then quickly that got spun into conspiracy theories as well. It happened so fast, that means they're just using us as guinea pigs. No, it didn't. That isn't actually what happened. But, you know, there's a kind of a variable at play here. I often think the internet is, and I think many people have said this, that the internet is one of the advent of the internet is one of the largest and most significant changes in human history because of the way things happen. So we can both frighten ourselves to death and promote and send around information, share information, and solve problems. It can go both ways. So the pandemic, I think, really brought that to the fore. And we got through the pandemic. And here we are. It's still lingering. Some people in my lab recently just got COVID, and it spread through a couple of families because they have small children. And yet here we are, the COVID, we're all acting as if it never happened to some extent. You know, there are lingering changes, but we're hardly wearing masks anymore. We're not worried about it anymore. And that's only a few years. Right? So we do get through these things, yet at the time it seemed like the world was ending. And the next major thing, something else will happen, and we'll again feel like the world is ending. And that's just the way our minds work. So that's what we have.
You also wrote The Other Side of Sadness, which focuses on bereavement and on loss. Can the steps to bolster our resilience be applied when grieving also?
Yes, absolutely. At the time that I was studying bereavement, I hadn't worked out any of the details of flexibility that I've described for you now, but it's absolutely the same approach during bereavement. And it's really that flexibility idea is how we cope with really anything adversive, anything difficult, anything unwanted, even smaller events, like daily events, like, say, losing your wallet or, you know, you have a problem in your life. You're dependent on a car to get somewhere, and your car is in the shop. Or you're, you know, you you lost some money in an event, and now you have to figure out how to pay your rent or make other payments. All of these things are problems that we have a practical side, but also the emotional side. And it can be used for all of those problems. And loss is a perfect example, because the pain of loss doesn't go away instantly. And it lingers off and on. But even resilient people to bereavement, and most people are resilient to death of a loved one as well. It doesn't mean they don't have pain. It doesn't mean they have moments of intense sadness, but they find ways to manage it. And that's exactly what the flexibility, regulatory flexibility, that idea is. We have a problem. We have a difficulty. We have to figure out, how do I get past this? How do I deal with it? It's the same thing.
Some great advice there. The books are called The End of Trauma and The Other Side of Sadness. Professor George Banana, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure, Matthew. It's been great to talk with you.
Well, thank you for listening to this episode of the Happy Habit Podcast. If you're enjoying tuning in, if you're enjoying listening, and if you've not already done so, please like, subscribe, share with other people in your life, and do leave the podcast a positive rating. Until next time, stay happy.